The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, yesterday morning my wife was showing me a cartoon in the paper, and it had this gigantic fat lady laying on top of this skinny little guy. And the fat lady, it said, "My big fat Greek wedding," and the fat lady was debt, and the little guy underneath was Greece. Now, we've just heard that there's a solution again in the Greek problem. Is it?
No, the tragedy is supposed to be over, and it's anything but over, Kevin, because, I mean, the realities are the numbers don't work for them. They've got too much debt, and they still haven't gotten rid of enough of it. And you'd think, okay, well, if investors are willing to take a haircut, and banks are willing to take a haircut, and we're willing to extend the terms of the existing loans and turn them into new products, Kevin, they don't have an economy that can support the debt that they have. And it was only minutes after they came to an agreement that a report was leaked to the Financial Times, an official document, that said actually by 2020, even though the stated goal and our promise and intention is to get us to 120% of debt to GDP by the year 2020, it's going to be more like 160%. And Kevin, if you think about that, here's how the math works. If you have 60% more debt than GDP, essentially you have negative compounding.
Right. Negative. It sounds like you're going backwards at that point.
You are going backwards. I mean, just as you want to grow your assets at a 5%, 7%, 8%, 10% rate of return, and that compounds positively, well, debt compounds negatively against you. And when you have more debt than your economy can support, that essentially is a game over. And this goes back to the study that was done by Reinhardt and Rogoff, where they said, actually, it's not even 100% of debt to GDP where you reach a critical point. It's 90%. So, right. 110, 120, the Greek admission of 160. Kevin, it's just the fact that they will play this out as long as they possibly can, ultimately either be expelled or voluntarily leave from the European Union, and then at that point get rid of their debt via either an outright devaluation of the currency or default. Okay. It's still in the works, Kevin. It's just a question of having 1 year, 2 year, 3 years more where they get to siphon off funds from the rest of Europe.
Well, what amazes me, though, Dave, is the guys who went out and bought Greek debt, they hedged themselves. They bought insurance. They bought derivative contracts that would pay in case that, you know, there was a default in the economy. Now they've been asked to take not a 50% cut, but a 53.3% cut.
And the bad news is that those insurance contracts are not going to pay, because there technically was no default. So they lose on both sides. They paid the premium for the insurance, and there is no compensation for what should be considered a default, but it's technically not. So they lose both sides.
Well, and we talk about they, okay? We talk about they, those crazy people who would buy Greek debt. Well, they is us, because you've got institutions worldwide who buy debt all the time, and then they insure it. It's a hedging process. Most financial institutions have to hedge their bet, otherwise they do take a 53.3% haircut.
Well, Kevin, I think if anything, we've just moved towards a resolution in the press, and for the next few weeks, perhaps there'll be some respite from the headlines of an imminent Greek demise. So we've pushed that off perhaps 12 months, 24 months, 36 months. Perhaps it becomes on a more accelerated time scale. But I think for the time being, they have sufficiently bought time.
Well, let me ask you, though. I'm Irish, okay? Kevin Orrick, I'm Irish, and I'm sitting here, let's say I'm in Ireland, and I'm going, well, gosh.
Those guys got a great deal.
I can't pay my debt. How about you just go ahead and do it for me, you know?
Can you reduce it by 50% for me, too? I'll buy you Guinness.
Well, and then Portugal and Spain.
And Greece and Italy. I mean, you really are looking at this. There are implications from the negotiation, and you're going to see all of these other countries, again, as you mentioned, Ireland, but certainly Portugal, Greece, Spain, and Italy, looking to carve out as good a deal or better deal, and they know that they, in some sense, have an upper hand. And here's what I mean by that, because essentially the EU needs them in more than they need to be in. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's the issue of they're willing to maintain this commitment to the EU project, the Eurozone project, at a very high cost, and we can to some degree milk that. And that's essentially what you've put in play with all of these other countries still having the same kinds of problems. In fact, it was just over the weekend that Bloomberg ran ran an article about how Spain's numbers were deteriorating rapidly. Okay. We already know that Portugal, if you look at their CDS spreads, are already in a very precarious place.
Everyone's, well, Italy is a gigantic problem.
Yeah, now, yields have gotten better in Italy, so we're back to September levels for Italian bonds, but still, the debts have not gone away. Structurally, nothing has changed. What we have is, again, a little bit of respite, a little bit of a calming of nerves in the market. I'll tell you, Kevin, what has me very concerned is actually what's happening here in the United States. One, in our market, the stock market, and number two, in the dollar, is sort of the undercurrents within the currency system.
Well, let's look at the dollar for a second, because the dollar's had somewhat of a boost with this European crisis. And, you know, every time they kick it down the road, the dollar, you know, people say, well, Europe's not going to make it in the long run, but maybe it's going to now. But the dollar has not really fallen much because of what's going on across the Atlantic. Now, my question would be this. The dollar's a reserve currency, okay? It's something that's been solid in the bank accounts, these big central banks, for, what, since 1945, basically. But now, David, we're seeing the dollar hollowed out, and people are starting to mistrust the dollar, but they're still holding it because it's what they commonly use for transactions.
Yeah, so there's actually two themes in that, Kevin, because on the one side, you've got the official holding of treasuries and right. U.S. dollar-denominated assets. So just as an example, the Chinese have over $3 trillion in currency reserves, and the majority of that, close to 60%, is assumed to be in dollar-denominated assets, many of those treasuries.
And the European banks.
Well, exactly.
Right?
And so you have the dollars held as reserves, which are one thing to focus on. And certainly we look at the TIC flows on a regular basis to see if individual central banks are beginning to reduce their holdings. And we've seen some of that occur on an accelerated basis, but that actually is not our primary concern. We have a very different concern within the currency markets.
Well, David, it is. It's interesting because we look at what's in banks as reserve and we say, well, the dollar must solidly still be holding its place. You know, that was put together in the Bretton Woods time when the dollar was still backed by gold. But there seems to be something happening worldwide right now where countries are starting to pay for things in something other than dollars. Now, they're happy to maintain their dollar reserves, but, you know, we just heard that China and India are looking to pay for oil with gold to Iran. Now, that's not the petrodollar. That's not the dollar monopoly that we wanted to see in place.
Well, and essentially what we're seeing happen, Kevin, and we talked about this when we interviewed Barry Eichengreen a number of months ago, is essentially the democratization of the currency markets, whereas we've been dealing with a dictatorship in the post-Bretton Woods era. I mean, we had everything centered on the U.S. dollar following 1944 when we met at the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and all the world's central banks agreed to use the dollar as the reference point.
Well, it was backed by gold back then.
And it was not only the reference point, but it was the currency through which invoices would be settled, through which transactions would be settled, and it set the stage for what you just described as dollar dominance in the world of commodity transactions. So we do have two themes here, Kevin. One is the dollar as a reserve asset, which again, if we suggest that the Chinese have $3 trillion in reserve assets and 60% of that is in dollars, we need to keep them very happy, very pacified. Mm-hmm. What would happen to the U.S. dollar if they were to dump their treasury holdings? Let me suggest that it doesn't matter, because what is more significant is an economy that is close to $4 trillion in total and is being re-engineered to settle trades around the U.S. dollar, whereas many of those transactions have taken place in U.S. dollar terms. The monumental agreement, which was signed in December, this was a bilateral agreement between the Japanese and the Chinese to begin settling their transactions in their own currencies. And Kevin, of course, you know, this is not the first time. We've seen the Chinese do this with Argentina. We've seen them do this with many of the cross-border transactions in their own neighborhood. When they're looking at Asian trade, when they're looking at trade settlement with Europe, when you're looking at trade settlement with anyone except their trade partner, the U.S., they're interested in settling transactions in a different currency, no longer the U.S. dollar. And this is far more important than how reserves are constituted.
Well, now, David, you know, we talked to Barry Eichengreen, and he wrote a book called Exorbitant Privilege. And what he was saying was the United States has enjoyed something that no other country enjoys. That is, we can print the world's transactional and reserve currency as much as we'd like. We basically buy products with that, and then those dollars dollars come back into our fold. It has to be reinvested in the United States because the Chinese don't use the dollar in their own economy.
Well, Kevin, and this, you know, Jacques Rouff, going back to the 1960s, he made this argument with a number of central bankers at the time. He said, you know, I wouldn't be as careful about the number of suits I ordered if the tailor returned my money to me immediately after paying it.
Right.
And this is the issue. We tend to overindulge in terms of our consumptive habits and run these trade deficits, and we're allowed to because the money that we send out is recycled back in the form of savings from foreigners.
Okay, so David, let me ask you this. We started out with Greece. We started out with the euro. We've talked to an awful lot of people who said, you know, you can just count the euro out. It's not making it. It's not holding together. You've said something different. You've told us all, don't count the euro out, because the world is getting sick of just leaning only on this hollow shell of a dollar. Are you thinking that the euro will be one of the key currencies in the future, even with the problems that they have right now?
Kevin, if you look at what has happened over the last 10 years within the euro, you've seen the value of the euro compared to the dollar go from 0.85 up to 1.6, and now it's hovering right around 1.3. Now, to be above a one-to-one relationship with the dollar, in spite of all the things that have happened within the eurozone.
What does that say about the
dollar?
It's
very remarkable in terms of the support given to the euro. And yes, the dollar is its own story in terms of an internal weakness. But as I look at the euro, it should be back at a one-to-one if it were losing credibility. In fact, it's not losing credibility at all. You have Asian support for the currency. You have Middle Eastern support for the currency. And of course, you have European support for the currency. But essentially, the reason you have support for the currency is this desire to move away from dollar monopoly status, or dollar dictatorship, if you will, and towards currency democracy. I mean, there's really no, I mean, I realize we're borrowing political terms here. They want more of a fair balance between the currencies, and they've decided to not do that via reserve assets, but in fact begin to change the plumbing, if you will, within international trade. And this is via the transaction settlement and invoice payments, which have typically taken place in U.S. dollar terms, thus forcing institutions, whether it's commercial banks or even your central banks, to hold vast stocks of dollars so that world trade can be settled in this currency.
So let's rewind the tape a little bit, David. Let's go back almost 100 years. Let's go back to the 1920s, okay, 90 years from where we are right now. And we, at that time, the British Empire, and London in particular, was the financial, transactional, and reserve base of the world. Countries that wanted to actually do international business had to have business with London. You had the British sovereign, which was the world's premier currency at the time. It was gold-backed. But there were some cracks showing up in London being the financial center of the world.
Well, and certainly a part of this was frailty within their own political and geopolitical structure. They were losing a grip that they had had for over 100 years. And they had that in large part because of their military. Their military and an advancement in a naval project, a secure currency, all of these things played well into their success.
Similar to the United States right now, George Friedman says, he who controls the navy and the seas of the world actually controls the world.
But in the 1920s, Kevin, you were already seeing London hollowed out, and you were seeing the pound sterling hollowed out. We saw a capitulation in the early 30s and a devaluation of the currency, the pound sterling, in the 30s. And then, of course, shortly thereafter, the U.S. dollar was devalued by 65%, almost in lockstep with the pound. But what happened, Kevin, is in that hollowing out process, the U.S. dollar became the marginal beneficiary of suspicion thrown on the pound sterling. And we're seeing that happen, Kevin, with the euro, where it's not necessarily winning on the basis of its own merits. It's just winning on the basis of dollar demerits and a desire to move away from a dollar-centric universe. So, Kevin, this is a report that I would encourage our listeners to get a hold of, because this is an issue that's explored well from a European perspective. I'm talking about the Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin. It's number 62. So if you go to the LEAP 2020 website, and we have the link available on our webpage, if you go to that and order the report, either order it as a standalone copy or subscribe annually, absolutely worth it. Kevin, one of the things that they ask in this report is what proportion of the transactions are being invoiced in which currency. And the vast majority have been, for the last 40, 50, 60 years, been invoiced in U.S. dollars. The real question here, Kevin, is why is the world still using the U.S. dollar as a middleman currency?
Right.
It's no longer necessary. If there's anything that we've learned in this digital age of buying things either via eBay or some other online auction site, you don't need the middleman.
Right.
You don't need the middleman. So, but here we are, transactions between the Japanese and the Chinese are settled in dollars. Why?
Yeah.
And that's the question asked, and the answer has already been taken. And guess what that means? A bilateral trade agreement in which the dollar is no longer the middleman, and the flow of currency no longer, the need to have our currency available to settle those transactions is no longer required.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. Well, and you know, David, the question has come up many times in the past. Why did the dollar not collapse in 1971 when Nixon closed the gold window? And a big part of that was the agreement that the dollar still was going to be the middleman. It was going to be the bridge you had to cross every time. Let's say you're Japanese and you want to buy oil. Well, you're going to first convert yen to dollars and then buy your oil. The exchange used to be in the World Trade Center when the World Trade Center was there, and it was all dollar denominated.
Right. Well, Kevin, I think this is essentially what's changing. We've run huge trade deficits, but the surplus trade partners, you know, they've sent those dollars back to us in the form of overseas savings. That has acted as a prop for the dollar and perpetuated this sort of cycle of overindulgence. It goes a long way towards explaining why there are reserves held by foreign companies, foreign banks, and foreign central banks in dollars. But again, the point here is not that those reserve allocations are necessarily going to shift. They may. That presents its own set of problems. But that is not front and center what is going to cause a significant decline in the dollar over the next 24 months. What is going to cause a significant decline, upwards of 20 to 30% in the next 24 months, is the change in plumbing, the substructure of transactions, global trade no longer being done in dollars but in currencies between individual trade partners. We're losing our middleman status.
Do you think maybe this is why the experts who are monitoring the cockpit, let's say, of the dollar are still missing this? Because they're monitoring bank reserves. And, you know, a bank reserve, you talked about $3 trillion, you know, and the majority being in dollars. And that, of course, is the case all across the world. There's still a lot of dollars in bank reserves. But you compare that to transactions, actual buying and selling of products around those reserves.
And that country itself has $3.75 trillion in annual GDP. So, I mean, we're dealing with an economy that if they can begin to define their transactions in terms of euros, in terms of yuan, in terms of yen, and not in terms of dollars, here's one of the things that you're eliminating. Kevin, again, I like the example because this is a trade agreement that's already been reached, but these two countries are both taking currency risk by going into the dollar. And it's unnecessary currency risk both of them have to be subjected to.
Sure.
Ordinarily, only one in a currency transaction will have to take the risk.
What you're saying is, in the middle of a transaction, if they have to go to dollars and then move to something else, they still have to worry about whether the dollar rises or falls during that transaction.
You bet. Or they incur an expense to hedge that out.
Right.
You can hedge away the risk, but now there's an increased cost in terms of the transactions because they're dollar-based. It's a brilliant move. It's a subtle move. It's a move that we're not in control of, because it's not something that's determined by the WTO. It's not something that's determined by the G7 or the G8. These are individual country bilateral trade agreements which are being signed to the exclusion of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. the benefit then to the U.S. economy.
So the moral to the story of what we're talking about currency-wise is don't count the euro out, even with all that's going on over there, and don't bet too heavily on the dollar right now, because we probably are seeing a hollowing out and ultimately a shrinking.
Well, our concern about the dollar has always been long term. I think you can fast forward and say 12 to 24 months is really a wake-up call for us as we see a 20 to 30% decline in the dollar. Now, that begins to remake a number of other asset classes. We're not here today to talk about the metals markets per se. We're not here today to talk about some areas that would do actually quite well in an adjustment phase to new and lower dollar values. But we do have very strong concerns in terms of the U.S. equity market. And there's some fundamental and technical dynamics which we should explore.
Dave, let's shift to the stock market and the equities market. We're seeing the stock market rising right now, but there are some particular patterns. Strangely enough, they seem very optimistic. The patterns of bullishness, the patterns of new highs being hit. There's a lot of patterns out there right now that are making people who maybe don't know that much about the stock market think maybe we're in the beginning of a new bull market. What are some of the things that you're seeing, Dave, that are causing concern?
Kevin, last week we sent out a breaking news flash to all of our viewers and listeners that we're seeing an undercurrent in the market where there's still rising prices within the equity markets, but on lower and lower volumes. Mm. And this is usually not a characteristic of fledgling bull market, but in fact, a rising trend, a rally trend, if you will, in the context of a broader and longer-term bear market. That's where you've consistently seen these kinds of patterns. If you're looking at a chart, it's what they would call a rising wedge, and that's what we highlighted in the breaking news release last week, is that we're in a very precarious place. The equity markets either need to break out considerably to the upside. We don't see the fundamental reasons why it would at this point. So really, the only thing driving prices higher from this level would be outside stimulus. In other words, an announcement of quantitative easing 3, further stimulus from the ECB, the Bank of England, you know, what they did just a few weeks ago with another $50 billion in pounds to support the economy there. I mean, that kind of an effort is enough to buoy prices, but you have to understand that the fundamentals within the market are actually deteriorating rapidly.
David, we talked about this. Right now, there's probably about a $10 upside for every $50 downside as far as the risk goes. It's about a five-fold risk to the downside versus maybe a one-times risk to the up.
Right. We've got a lot of respect for Bill King. He's a guy who's been on the program a number of times. And one of the things that he's highlighted here recently is the divergence between high-yield bond funds and stocks. And this is the consistent pattern over the last several years where high-yield bond funds and stocks have moved in lockstep. And in fact, the high-yield bond funds have usually preceded or have come before a major move, either up or down within the equities
market. It's a little like the parakeet in the mine. You know, it's that you want to watch to see if that thing's still alive. So the high-yield bond fund is the parakeet. If it's going up, the stock market probably is. But if it goes down and the stock market keeps going up, stop breathing the air in the mine.
And that's exactly what we have, is stocks are still rising with the high-yield bond market deteriorating rapidly. It's already correcting. Meanwhile, stocks are somehow levitating to higher levels. We think stocks will fall in line with that. So, again, one pattern to look at is that divergence currently between the high-yield bond funds and stocks.
Well, and Dave, it's the law that if you're executive or a CEO at a company and you own stocks in your company, you're considered an insider. Now, it's a legal insider, but you can't do anything without reporting to everyone what you're doing. When you buy stocks, it's reported. When you sell your stocks, like when Bill Gates sells Microsoft, it's reported. Now, that's another parakeet, isn't it? It's something that we can watch.
It is, Kevin. And what it really tells you is whether or not someone who is operating the business sees the stock as overvalued or undervalued. If it's undervalued, then it's like picking up $100 bills on the street. It's free money.
Right.
They're going to continue to do their job. Ultimately, the shares are going to be priced higher, and they're going to make a killing on their stock options.
Sure, you want to own stocks in your own company if you think it's going to do better this year.
Exactly. Now, there's a few companies that are an exception to this, where they regularly sell their shares because it's one of the primary forms of compensation. And this is particularly in the technology sector, where low compensation in terms of dollars, but high compensation in terms of stocks. So people are regularly, including the Gates family, regularly selling Microsoft and things like that. So take that out of the equation, if you will, and then just look at, say, the top 20 companies in the country. And what you find, Kevin, is there's about 11.6 liquidations for every purchase. Now, that's actually a transaction. If you dig a little bit deeper and look into the shares bought versus shares sold, the actual quantities of the volumes, if you will, of purchases versus liquidations. And by the way, Alan Newman in his reports, Cross Currents,
right,
absolutely vital. I suggest that everyone subscribe to Cross Currents, Alan Newman's monthly newsletter, and the Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin. Both of these are fantastic reads. And Kevin, what I like about this is he goes a little bit more granular into it this month and saying, listen, we had 398,000 shares that were bought.
The 11.6 out there were buying.
Compared to over 50 million shares sold.
Which is the one. So 11.6 to 1, the 11.6 were buying only 398,000 shares. The one was selling 50 million shares.
That's correct. Just to show you, and again, we said we wanted to take Microsoft out of the picture. That puts you, instead of 126 to 1 on the volume statistics, more like 100 to 1. 100 to 1 in terms of volume of liquidation by insiders compared to the purchases by insiders. And again, Kevin, this is just an indication that this has been consistent, actually, for 10 years, but it tends to spike in terms of liquidations in anticipation of major declines in the equity markets, where they feel like stocks are actually as high valued as they're going to be, and you might as well cash in now because tomorrow or in the next few years, we're not going to see higher values. That's executives, people running the businesses, saying, from an operational standpoint, we don't see upside.
Well, I'll tell you one that scares me, though, a little bit, David, because there are a lot of people who are listening right now have an investment advisor. And, you know, they poll investment advisors. And strangely enough, anytime investment advisors are highly bullish, that's usually the top of a market. And right now, the investment advisors' polls are showing them to be very, very positive about the market.
Yeah, close to 55% are bullish today, 54.8. And that's on par with last July's numbers. You know, this is the real issue. When you run out of buyers, Kevin, prices decline.
Right.
When you run out of buyers, prices decline.
This is the key to contrarian thinking. You don't want to be buying when the investment advisors are bullish. You want to have purchased when they were
bearish.
When they were bearish.
And this is the point. That's where there's best value. When the market is throwing in the towel, not when the whole market is jumping on board.
Right.
When, in fact, the market has already jumped on board. And this is another statistic, Kevin, which just goes to the point that we're very concerned about equity prices today. If someone owns an equity portfolio, we would suggest they lighten up, they hedge, they do whatever they can, because there's tremendous downside risk and limited upside risk, with upside only being supported by central bank intervention. Mutual funds, they are nearly invested to the gills. In other words, fully invested with less cash today than they had in 2007, 2008, just before the market crashed. Fully invested then, with the idea that there was only upside. They're fully invested now with the idea that there's only upside. The only other time that we've seen this, Kevin, where they had low, low cash reserves, 1999, early 2000, before the market collapsed there. So again, you see them make a full commitment because, to be honest with you, Kevin, asset managers in general, are more concerned about missing the next up move than they are about protecting the downside, because many of them are very sanguine about what it means to lose money. We are not, but many investment advisors are. If an investment advisor loses money and it's on par with the rest of the market, then relatively speaking, they can't be punished for it. You're not going to move your assets. That investment advisor loses 10%, everybody else lost 10%, there's no motivation to move money. But they will find money leaving assets under management if, on the upside, you only return 10% while everyone else returned 15 or 20. That's when you see a migration to other asset managers. People on the basis of greed will reallocate and be chasing returns. So what they're afraid of is being left out of the next move higher. More concerned about that than they are the next move lower, because frankly, everybody loses on the downside.
Well, you know, that's a common theme that we hear. We'll be talking to clients and they'll say, well, of course, you know, my assets are doing fine, except in 2008. And of course, everybody lost in 2008. Now, that's not true. There were those who did not lose in 2008 who saw it coming. But for the most part, the investment advisors got a break, because most, it was the majority that had lost in 2008. Now, here's something that I think is an analogy, though, Dave. We talk about politicians making decisions based purely on getting reelected every 4 years, what have you. And it really hurts the long-term strategy. It's the same thing, I think, with investment advisors. They're looking at the next gain, worried that they're going to lose money if somebody beats them.
Well, and our concern, frankly, Kevin, is much more along the lines of the major trends, and the major trends which are propelling asset values up or down over a longer period of time. We don't compete with investment advisors on that basis. The major trend is either at your back or it's not. You either have wind in your sails or you do not. We talked about this when we were down in the Bahamas with a number of clients in recent weeks, Kevin. Trading in the stock market today is like picking up pennies in front of a steamroller.
Right.
There's simply not enough reward in it given the risk that's right there. Contextually, the risk is too great. So you want to know that, now granted, and this is what someone pointed out in the crowd, they said, but if it was kilo bars or Krugerrands, would you be out there?
Yeah.
And I said, actually, I'd be out there in flip-flops.
A little bit more reward for the risk.
Exactly.
But you're saying pennies are not worth risking your life in front of a steamroller.
No, nor your savings. And yet that's what investment advisors are doing today. Kevin, we've seen a slight improvement in terms of margin debt. This is another variable to consider when looking at how speculative the markets are today. Margin debt has declined off of its peaks of over $350 billion. It's right around $300 billion today. That puts it right at the same level as it was at 1999, 2000, right as the tech stocks were cresting, if you will. But it is below the all-time highs that we saw back in 2007 and early 2008, where it got stretched actually above $400 billion. So the threshold there is sort of $350.
Yeah.
Still reason to be concerned. I mean, just note that there is plenty of speculative money in terms of people borrowing from their advisors to increase their returns, enhance their returns by using the house's money to invest with.
Well, so then if I could give a word picture here, if you were in Vegas right now, you'd see all the mutual funds chips on the table, but maybe $3 in their pocket for every $100 worth of chips, or $97 worth of chips on the table. But not only that, margin debt, in other words, borrowing from the house, is also getting near. Those are chips on the table. There's no more cash to go into this market. There's the $3 that they have in their pocket. That's it. So, again, the question is this. Whether we have negative or positive news, there's just no new energy coming in.
Right. On top of that, Kevin, you look at the bearish bets against the market, and you could say, well, listen, maybe there's short covering rallies from here. Maybe there is someone who's short the market who's going to be covering their short positions, and that's going to add steam to the market.
Explain that. Explain a short covering rally. For the person who takes a short, who basically says, no, I'm going to bet against the stock market instead of for the stock market.
And hope that it goes down.
Something follows that. If it doesn't happen, right? There's a short cover.
Right. So if I close out that trade, essentially what I'm doing is buying back those shares and adding energy in terms of a purchase of those shares.
To the positive side.
To the upside.
Yeah,
to the upside.
The market.
So as you cover a short, there is positive momentum to the upside. The problem is, Kevin, we've got the lowest level of bearish bets, these market shorts, that we've had in 10 years.
Wow.
In 10 years. So you've got no one who's bearish today. You've got the investment advisors who are rabidly bullish. You've got mutual funds who are fully invested. Kevin, you've got a rising wedge where prices continue to increase, and yet volume is falling off. Kevin, we are on the cusp of reversal. We would suggest that you've got a 1,000 to 2,000 point decline immediately in front of you in the Dow, same percentage declines in the S&P 500. And guess why you can't go short to the gills?
Because the government could print money.
And that's the problem.
It's
is
an
in this
year.
Environment,
yeah.
In an election year,
yeah.
In a not just our election year, but it's a Spanish election year, it's an Italian election year, it's a French election year, it's a Belarusian election year. Kevin, you've got 50% of the G20 that are in the same throes we are, looking at a punk economy,
right.
And trying to get reelected, trying to convince the electorate that you're doing a good job and things have actually improved on your watch.
And really, their only tool is to print money.
Monetary policy and basically flogging the money supply. That's what we've seen happen so far. We think we'll continue to see it. Central banks around the world accommodating as best they can. So you look at incredible frailty, and for us, to be short the market is only to hedge out other positions. You don't necessarily want to speculate on the short side because central bank activity can get ramped up in radical ways. Just like we saw the Chinese back in 2009 throw $1 trillion into the marketplace. Now, it didn't help stocks in China, but it did stabilize the economy to some degree.
So, David, just to use a summary quote from Alan Newman, who you were quoting from Cross Currents, he says, for now, we're in a high-risk zone, and you don't need to know much more. In other words, you probably ought to keep your powder dry, have your third to 50% in gold in the triangle, have some maybe in the equities markets and some in cash, but don't go out there and put all the chips on the table.
No, I think your best bets are probably in the precious metals sector and in cash at this point. Those two giving you tremendous buying power in the midst of a decline. Now, Newman's sentiment indicators are fantastic. He's suggesting that there is a major top, the bears are becoming bullish, and that usually precedes a major reversal in the market. So, Kevin, from a technical standpoint, from a fundamental standpoint, who's actually in the market buying today? We see there being heightened risk, very little appreciation for the risks that are in the marketplace today. And again, you may have a few last-minute suckers who step in and buy equities. The only basis that you have for betting on equities today is central bank intervention. That's a crapshoot. That's hoping against hope that the central banks come out with another bailout strategy and it happens to see those dollars flow to the markets that you're positioned in. There is the ability by central banks, Kevin, to create money. There is no ability for them to direct the flow. And that's where, unless the central bank is actively purchasing a particular asset class, whether it's mortgage-backed securities or whatnot, liquidity is provided, and it doesn't necessarily have to go where they want it. We see that in terms of current excess reserves with your depository institutions, with nearly $1.6, $1.7 trillion of liquidity that's been created by the central bank, has been taken in by the banks themselves, the commercial institutions, and put back on deposit with the Fed because they're not willing to risk it in the marketplace today. They're not willing to loan it out because they don't think it's a good bet. Is that a little strange, Kevin? Banks not willing to lend? That's how they make their money, is putting more money into the marketplace. And yet you have record amounts. We've never seen this amount of money sitting redeposited with the Fed by these depository institutions. Does that tell you anything? That, along with insider selling, that people who are in the know look at the economy and say, no, absolutely not. We will not place our money on that particular bet. The only money we're willing to bet is other people's money. That's a sad story.
So, David, just in summary, we talk about the triangle often, and I'm bringing it up again because really the triangle really forces a person to look at the long-term trends and ignore the short-term fads, let's call it. And really the fad right now, David, is this bullishness in the market that really has no support.
Well, Kevin, I think there's a couple of other things that are worth addressing here because you look at the prospective triangle and part of it is insurance related. That's gold and silver at the base of the triangle. You look at the left side of the triangle and it may have a growth thematic or an income thematic, stocks, bonds, your typical asset classes there on the left-hand side of the triangle. On the right-hand side of the triangle, it's cash, cash equivalents, foreign currencies, what have you. There you have liquidity mandate being fulfilled by a variety of vehicles.
Right.
Kevin, there's a number of advisors out there today who are suggesting that gold will sell down to $1,000 an ounce, silver will sell down to $10, $15, and that's when you want to be buying it. And they're assuming radical strength in the dollar. Kevin, I think one of the things that they are forgetting is that the dollar is not what it used to be.
Right.
The dollar is no longer connected to gold in any way, shape, or form. And in a deflationary or deleveraging event, people moving to the best possible credit, that is what has happened historically. And that is what has happened in the 1930s and every other period of deflation leading up to the current situation we have today. And in fact, gold did very well in every one of those equations.
Gold did well. The dollar did well only when it was still tied to gold, is what you're saying. Now
that's
that it's
right.
not tied to gold, we have to consider deflation from a gold perspective, not a dollar perspective.
Well, and what you see in the last 10 years, Kevin, is a radical deflationary cycle.
Everything's gotten cheaper in
gold terms.
Yeah.
In gold terms. So essentially, looking at equities, listen, you've just increased your purchasing power 6 times, 600% with this insurance component in your portfolio. It now buys 6 times the amount of equities that it bought. And we're in the cycle where your purchasing power is likely to increase another 4, 5, or 6 times yet again.
Well, and Dave,
here within the next 2 or 3 years.
You used the example last week about houses as well. You know, the same amount of money that would have purchased a house 5 years ago, the same amount of gold, now buys 4.5. Now, that's an amazing increase in buying power, but you're saying we're just halfway there.
Right. I don't think anyone wants a dent to their reputation. When looking at these financial matters and trying to assume that the U.S. dollar has a constant value from then till now, no one should go through that kind of pain and come out the other side with the realization that they missed one of the great bull markets of all time and were subjected to one of the great deflations, but were in the wrong denomination for their savings. Kevin, I think that's simply a dent you can't afford for your reputation.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.